Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. During the last several decades, the United States has been involved in a number of conflicts, and now our military is practicing to prepare for potential conflict with China. We rely on a volunteer force of men and women to keep us safe, and we owe it to them to care for them if they are injured while on duty, and that includes caring for their psychological health. But for many veterans, finding mental health care can be a struggle. For evidence, consider this. While military veterans constitute roughly 6% of the adult population, they make up about 20% of all suicides. As of 2021, an average of almost 18 veterans committed suicide every day. That, as many who seek out care through the Veterans Administration often run into roadblocks from scheduling issues to canceled appointments. There are signs of progress, however. We have reduced the number of unhoused veterans by more than half, and new treatments offer promise. On this Veterans Day, we look at the challenges faced by our veterans and at some reasons for optimism that things may be improving. We're joined by Dr. Justin Johnson, a psychiatrist and director of Veteran and First Responder Services at Hopeway. That's a nonprofit behavioral health and mental health treatment center in Charlotte offering specialized services for veterans. Dr. Johnson is also a member of the U.S. Army Reserves, where he is a command psychiatrist at Fort Liberty. Dr. Rajiv Ramchand is also with us, senior behavioral scientist and co-director of the Rand Epstein Family Veterans Policy Research Institute. Matthew Smead is a veteran and a licensed clinical mental health counselor and program manager for Veterans Bridge Home, which works to provide support services to help veterans reintegrate into civilian life. And we're also joined by a U.S. Army combat veteran who served in Afghanistan, a former Hopeway client. He prefers to use only his first name for this conversation. So we welcome Cameron to the program as well. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for being here, all of you. Dr. Johnson, I'm going to begin with you. The United States has created veterans since the very beginning of the Republic, because this thing all started with the Revolutionary War. But the problems that these veterans are facing, mental and physical, seem to be increasing. Are they, or are we simply more aware of them?
Yes, Mike. First of all, thanks for having us, all this great group of people today, Veterans Day. For this incredibly important topic. So, that's a good question. I think, ever since humans have been fighting war, so preceding the Republic, preceding the United States, people have had problems as a result of combat. So if you go back and read things like the Aeneid, for example, some of the characters in the Aeneid display things that now, ever since 1980, when PTSD was coined as the term, so ever since then, so now we would call post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. So I think that actually veterans have suffered with similar things for all of human history. But to dive a little bit deeper, I do think there are unique parts about the current recent conflicts and recent struggles of veterans that are probably a whole discussion in and of themselves. So things like after World War II, veterans came back and there were like jobs available and housing available, and there were things for veterans to immediately turn to, whereas in the current state of affairs for many veterans, they'll come back and not be able to find a job. For example, I've heard many veterans tell me things like, I had such a sense of purpose in the military, but when I came back, I was working at McDonald's or something like that. And it felt like it just was nowhere near the level of purpose that I had in the military. So I think that is something that's more unique today compared to perhaps previous generations. But in terms of the question of like, have veterans always struggle with things like PTSD? I think, unfortunately, they have.
Dr. Ramchand.
Yeah, and I would just add, our battlefield medicine has gotten so much better. The U.S. battlefield medicine right now is incredible. People can be severely wounded and injured, whereas in past conflicts, they would have been, they would have died, to be quite frankly. They're surviving these really traumatic injuries. And so the improvements in battlefield medicine may have you know, simultaneously resulted in an increase in the number of people who are now living and you know, have these now mental health conditions, sometimes as a result of those traumas.
Justin Johnson.
Yeah, I want to add back, that's an excellent point, Dr. Ramchand. So I think perfect example would be traumatic brain injury. So, you know, that's many people see as the signature injury from the post 9/11 conflicts, mostly in Iraq and Afghanistan, that, you know, the kinds of explosions that would have killed people in previous conflicts, now veterans survived, but unfortunately they're left with symptoms, you know, sequelae, we would say, of traumatic brain injury that often overlap with psychiatric disorders and even lead to psychiatric disorders. That's an excellent point, Dr. Ramchand.
Matt Smead, I know you want to get in on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, to your question, I just wanted to also add, you know, there is a lot less or lessening of stigma now around mental health, be it depression, anxiety, PTSD, or a whole other host of other diagnoses. There is a greater acceptance of the fact that people and veterans struggle with these things. So, you know, I do think it is coming to light and to the surface more. So it may seem more prevalent, but I think part of it is it's just more accepted and more talked about.
And I want to bring up something with you, Matt, that Dr. Johnson mentioned a second ago, that following World War II, veterans from that conflict came home. We had the GI Bill. We had veterans going to college. They were part of the generation that brought the baby boomers to the fore. So they had houses to go to, jobs to go to. They were celebrated as the heroes of saving the world from fascism. And in recent conflicts, that has not been the case, particularly after Vietnam. We let a lot of veterans languish. They were not well treated when they came home. And I'm sure that's changed since that conflict. But it does seem that we have fallen down on the job in making sure that we treat these people the way they should be treated, particularly when it comes to jobs and housing and reintegrating back into the world. And that is part of what you do. Is that our imagination at work, or have we, in fact, fallen down on the job?
You know, transition stress, as it is often called, when someone is leaving the military and transitioning back into the civilian world, it's very stressful for some of the reasons that you identified there. But also, it's stressful because a lot of these service members, you know, they don't have the mission they had when they were serving. They don't have the unit. They don't have the people they were relying on as they did when they're in the military, and therefore don't have some of the same supports. And transitioning into the civilian world can be a challenge for service members. Employment and housing are two of the biggest requests that we receive here at Veterans Bridge Home. And we, since our founding, you know, our goal really has been to help veterans and their families connect to the resources that they need, in conjunction with all of our partners across the community at various agencies, you know, such as my esteemed colleagues on this panel.
Dr. Johnson, veterans today in the system range from 18 to 100 years old. There are lots of them in there. 9 million people, I believe, are 9 million veterans are enrolled in VA healthcare at VA hospitals and outpatient clinics. And your organization, Hopeway, says that nearly 25% of active service members present signs of mental health conditions. That doesn't count those who have served and left the military. So is the problem that our system of service, the VA system, et cetera, is being overwhelmed by the sheer numbers of veterans who have been fighting in these recent conflicts? Or has the nature of what these veterans face, both in combat and once they return home, have somehow made it more difficult for them to cope?
Yeah, so I think, again, I think veterans have always struggled to some degree, particularly combat veterans. But just also, you know, as a psychiatrist taking care of patients struggling with mental health difficulties, many times veterans just have sort of more complex histories. I mean, it's when you're dealing with things like having traumatic brain injuries, plus veterans have way higher rates of obstructive sleep apnea, physical injuries that potentially come not even just from combat, but from doing things like airborne school or training just when you're back here in the United States. Those things can begin to, like, coalesce and create just sort of a complicated picture of both medical and psychiatric struggles that I think sort of usually leads to veterans needing a little bit more support and more care than maybe sort of an average outpatient mental health patient might struggle with. So I think that's been difficult. And one of the things, you know, that might make it seem like, you know, the VA is inundated just because they need so many supports oftentimes.
I want to add
one more point, though. An interesting observation. I think sometimes people have this view that, you know, veterans are just totally broken and are really struggling. And obviously many veterans are, but, you know, most veterans sort of go on and do good things. And also just much of the current struggles, at least in active duty military members, actually just reflects struggles broadly, like struggles, particularly among Generation Z, you know, ages 18 to 24. I see those same struggles among current active, like, military service members who've never been to combat. So I think it's maybe a big takeaway is our veterans and veteran struggles really just reflect struggles of culture and society, because that's who our veterans are. They're just American citizens.
We have an Afghanistan veteran with us in our midst. Cameron joins us, and I know you have something to say about this.
Yeah. Well, when I did have dealt with the VA, and, you know, I have had both good and, you know, struggling care over my years, one of the number one things is accessibility to practitioners. You know, they are overwhelmed with so many patients that it takes 30, 60, 90 days to get yourself an appointment. And this has caused a lot of, you know, stress. I mean, if you look in the Charlotte metro area, there is a hospital within 15 miles for, you know, standard civilians with healthcare, but you have one, you know, medical facility to handle all of Charlotte for the VA. And then you have, and it's not a hospital. So if you need hospital care, you have to go to Salisbury. So it's just the mass quantity of veterans that need help, it's just hard to facilitate that when you have, you know, you don't have an abundance of locations and ability to actually seek treatment.
Dr. Ramshan.
Yeah, Cameron points out a really important point, which is that this is a national issue, access to mental health care. This isn't restricted to veterans. And in many cases, the VA has guidelines and standards by which point, like at the duration for which when a veteran calls to make their appointment, they should be seen. Those don't exist in the civilian world. So in many ways, the VA has thresholds and is, you know, beholden to criteria set by Congress about when they can see patients. They also have standards of evidence-based care that really don't exist in the civilian society. So in many ways, the VA is doing very well. But what we see in mental health care in general is we see an increasing number of psychiatrists and psychologists not accepting insurance, being private pay. This is a trend in our country, paying in metro areas up to, you know, $250 to $500 a session to see a mental health care. So the demand is really kind of outpacing the supply, especially for affordable and accessible care, which is why the VA becomes so important, because they do have these thresholds. They do have these quality criteria and standards. So it's a really important kind of system to treat our veterans.
I have about 30 seconds, Dr. Ramshan, but it sounds to me like the need has outstripped the infrastructure that was designed probably after World War II to care for veterans from one conflict. And we've been in a series of wars since then, and it sounds like they haven't done much to expand the infrastructure. In 20 seconds, would that be accurate?
I don't think so. I think that they have expanded, but I think to your point, the supply, the demand is outpacing the supply.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of our conversation about the need for mental health care for veterans and how things are changing to help them more than perhaps we have in the past. There is a bright lining at the end of the tunnel, and we'll get to that later on in the program. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about veterans' needs for mental health care, and we're doing so with Dr. Justin Johnson, a psychiatrist, and Director of Veteran Services at Hopeway, Dr. Rajiv Ramshan, the Senior Behavioral Scientist and Co-Director of the Rand Epstein Family Veterans Policy Research Institute. Matthew Sneed is with us. He's a veteran and program manager for Veterans Bridge Home. And Cameron is also a veteran, prefers to use only his first name. He served two tours in the Army in Afghanistan. We will hear his story in a moment. Dr. Ramshan, among the mental health issues faced by returning veterans, there are feelings of sadness and hopelessness and worthlessness, anxiety, guilt, anger. Why would someone who served their country feel worthless or hopeless?
Well, not everyone does. I think mostly it's kind of feeling unsupported for those who kind of are struggling in that way. So, and I think that there's two things. There can be experiences during the military, whether those are combat experiences or things that are perpetuated kind of within the military culture, like military sexual trauma. Those can things can lead, we know psychologically, to some of the symptoms you discussed. Then if there is a feeling that there was injustice done by somebody, like say who was a victim of military sexual trauma, there could be a lack of trust in the government and the institutions that are supposed to be, that the person is supposed to think protects them in place. And then again, that can compound the systems you're talking to. And then when they leave the military, if they're in a society where we see this gap between military and civilians, we call it in the military civilian divide, where civilians don't understand nor appreciate the service that service members have had and the experiences they've had. And that can be employers don't experience the training that they've received in the military. All those can compound to create a sense of isolation. But I do also want to highlight that, you know, the veteran suicide issue, it is high among the transitioning service members, and that definitely is a period of risk. But we also see really larger numbers of particularly men who are older who are dying by suicide as well. So it's beyond that transition experience, and it's kind of people who are, you know, maybe at the verge of struggling with things like dementia or other issues.
I want to talk about this lack of understanding on the part of the civilian population about what goes on in the military and the struggles that some military vets face in a second. But Dr. Ramshan, you mentioned something else. You talked about sexual assault. Female veterans are part of the fighting force now, were part of the fighting force. They tend to be younger than their male counterparts. They are less likely, I'm told, to be white, more likely to have kids, and they have different health care needs, among them reproductive health and the fact that they may have suffered military sexual trauma, and their numbers are growing. From what you know, do they get the care they need? Is the military, is the VA system equipped really to deal with these relative newcomers to the fighting force?
Increasingly so, yeah. There's an Office of Women's Health within the VA. I think some of the challenges, and there are programs directly for them. Every person who attends a VA is screened for military sexual trauma. But unfortunately, we do see that compared to their civilian counterparts, women veterans have higher rates of suicide than non-veterans.
Are they more or less likely than men to seek help?
They're more likely. They're more like women veterans right now and the current generation are more likely to access their benefits from the VA and to engage in treatment and help seeking. But sometimes they might not feel comfortable at the VA. So which is why, you know, we really encourage that community providers who treat women who are more likely to see women are trained in veteran competency. So it's not just the VA needs to be prepared to treat treat women, but civilian providers need to be prepared to treat veterans, including women veterans.
So Dr. Johnson, we have this all-volunteer fighting force now. The majority of the population today has not served in the military. That means the majority of population really doesn't understand, can't really understand what these men and women have gone through during their time in the military, and probably have great difficulty understanding what they face when they come home. How big a problem is that for the veterans who need help, that they're just not understood?
Yeah, I think, you know, I see that struggle a lot. That's why I think, you know, it's so important for veterans to continue having some sense of community oftentimes. So organizations like some of the groups here, like Veterans Bridge Home, organizations that will bring veterans together to where they can still have that sense of camaraderie. actually, before I worked at Hopeway, I actually worked at the VA. I was a psychiatrist at the VA in Durham. And one of the main reasons many veterans came to the VA was just to get camaraderie, was to, like, we had veterans who would just hang out at the VA. They weren't there for any appointments. They would just hang out in the cafeteria, partially for the reasons you're saying, because they felt like that people got them there and that was a community. So I think that is an important difficulty for many vets.
Matthew, this is what you do. So give us your perspective on that.
Very much so. Another one of the key requests we get from the veteran community is social support. So at Veterans Bridge Home, we really focus on creating different events that veterans can come to, and not just Charlotte. We serve the Triangle, the Triad, the Sand Hills, and down into South Carolina. But regardless of where we are in the state, we are constantly holding different events that veterans and their families can come to, so they can get that support and have that camaraderie again. Because we're talking about, mental health and suicide prevention, but what this is, this is upstream suicide prevention. If these veterans, if they have the support, if they have people around them that care about them, they are going to be, a lot less likely to maybe one, develop more serious mental health issues, or two, potentially, deal with feeling suicidal. So it's a very big part of what we do.
And Matt, we seem to have both an alarming and an unacceptable number of homeless veterans. Many of the vets on our street are, in fact, suffering from mental health disorders or issues that stem from their time in combat. A year ago, I read, it was estimated that 268 veterans were experiencing homelessness in Mecklenburg County. How did we come to this?
Well, I think that could be a whole show in and of itself. But, the cost of living certainly has not gone down anytime in the recent past. It keeps going up. Housing is a challenge for all members of society, for the most part. It's getting more expensive for everybody. So in Mecklenburg County, there are concerted efforts amongst the agencies that tackle housing insecurity to work together to end veteran homelessness. We work very closely with the county to do this. Basically, all of these different community providers meeting regularly, talking about problems with housing our veterans and the rest of our unhoused people in the city, and working together to marshal our resources together and to streamline our processes so that we can bring the number of unhoused down. And we have been doing that here in Mecklenburg County. The number of unhoused veterans specifically, that number has been going down over the last few years, due in part to efforts like that.
Dr. Ramshan.
Well, I was going to say, it's a really important thing to address what we call these social determinants of health, like housing. Some of our best treatments for mental health conditions require somebody to come weekly, for example, for 8 to 12 weeks to see a therapist to go through some of these evidence-based cares. But if you're trying to find a house or if you're struggling to make ends meet, that's going to be really hard to achieve compliance with that type of treatment regimen, which is why housing is so important. But I just want to say the other thing about social connection that Matt was talking about. There's a really beautiful article today in the New York Times about veterans who are forming these social connections, but doing so in North Carolina, in the hills that are affected by Helene, and kind of finding both a sense of purpose and a sense of community in helping these recovery. And I know that Mission Continues is one organization that really kind of encourages veterans to do that. So it's forming that social network, but then also giving them that sense of purpose that Dr. Johnson was talking about earlier, after they leave the military, to continue to help and serve their community and serve their country, really, in these really inspiring ways.
We have a veteran with us, a veteran of the conflict in Afghanistan. Cameron is with us. Talk a moment, Cameron, about, because we talked a second ago about how the civilian population, the majority of them have never served, so they had difficulty understanding what you went through when you were in country and when you came home. talk about your service in Afghanistan and what you experienced. Where were you deployed and for how long?
So I was deployed, my first deployment was in Wardak province, which is just below Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. That was a, you know, mountainscape, you know, sitting at 7,200 feet above sea level, right out the gate. So very high elevation. And then, you know, we did operations through the valleys of the province. You know, to speak of the, that was a, I was 19 years old. My training consisted of basic training and then going to my base on Christmas Day of 2008. And I was in Afghanistan February 13th of 2009. So I did not receive, you know, a year of training, actual combat training with my unit prior to deployment. I was not prepared for what I was about to experience. You know, I have losing, you know, 28 friends that, you know, three of which I went to basic training with, and then losing these people, these friends, and also being in firefights and experiencing all these really traumatic events, you come home and you can't talk about it. You don't get coached per se, not a direct, hey, don't say that you have PTSD. Don't say you experience trauma. Don't say these things. They just said, you'll get over it. You'll be fine. Just, you know, adapt and overcome. And you don't need to worry about those things. You'll get through it.
Let me ask you a question. As I understand this, you're told not to talk about it, or you can't talk about it because it's too painful, or you can't talk about it because you know that the people around you wouldn't get it.
When I came home to my family, they wouldn't get it. And we didn't talk about it with amongst ourselves because we were men and we don't talk about our emotions. And that's kind of the aspect. And our leadership were like, we don't really want to hear it because then we have to do paperwork. And so you just kind of just shut it down. You just push it down until you get out. And
You said that nothing, you didn't get sufficient training. Can anything prepare you or anybody for what you went through, to lose all those buddies and to be in the, we'll talk about your situation in a second, but to be in the situation you found yourself in ultimately?
No, but I didn't, what I didn't gain was the camaraderie, you know, that you gain from doing training with the same guys and preparing, you know. I just went and it's like welding, you know, you're just putting the two pieces of metal together and the heat of war binds you.
What was it that attracted you? Because we have an all-volunteer force. Not everybody, most people don't go. You chose to. What made you choose to?
When I was a freshman in high school, I visited my dad in New Jersey, and I went to the World Trade Center site, and I saw what had happened. And I remember watching it when I was in sixth grade, watching the Twin Towers come down. And I knew right then and there that I wanted to serve and protect our country from that happening again.
While you were on patrol, as I understand your story, in Afghanistan in 2019, a truck that you were traveling in triggered an IED. It blew the truck up. It tossed it into the air. I'm told that this is a 10-ton truck that flew up into the air, and several of your friends were killed in that incident. Were you physically injured in that incident?
No, and that was a big struggle for me. That was a big, you know, the remorse that I wasn't hurt. I mean, I was bruised, but that was it. And I have no explanation of why or how, but I had a lot of guilt, and I carried that guilt for a long time.
So there's the guilt, there's also, I would think that there's just the trauma, the mental trauma of going through an incident like that, where you come within a hair's breadth of extinction, has got to have you have an effect on you mentally. Did those effects come to you quickly, or were they gradual? Did they overcome you gradually?
I really did not experience a lot of symptoms of, you know, post-traumatic stress until I was out of the military. You have the camaraderie, and when you're in, and you kind of just, you have the sense that you're so on mission all the time. You just go, hey, what are you going to do today? Whatever I'm told, I'm just going to go. Where when you get out, there's no one to say, hey, you know, chow's at this time, PT's at this time. You're just lost in your own thoughts. And you, I progressively, you know, started having more nightmares, you know, aggressive thoughts. And it kind of, it was hard for me to really maintain relationships or maintain like anything, semblance of a true life.
Did you seek out, I know you've gotten help, so did you seek that help out on your own? Because I know you were also at one point self-medicating. I think you were drinking, described as drinking too heavily. Did you seek it out on your own, or were you guided to it? Did someone in the family push you toward it? How did that work for you?
So before I went to Hopeway, I had everything culminated. I was drinking heavily, using it as self-medication to go to sleep. I was, you know, I had sought treatment from the VA, but the treatment was, you know, I had doctors actually, you know, they actually said, hey, you need to be seen 2-3 times a week to really kind of get combat this trauma, but we can only see you once a month. And that was a struggle, you know, so I kind of was like, oh, I can self-manage this. It culminated to a night where I drank too much. I drove, and which I'm ashamed of saying. And I came home, and my wife the next morning had packed a bag and said, you seek treatment, you get help for this stuff, or you get out. Because I can't live with this, and I can't have my kids raised around this.
I want to come back, talk more about Cameron's story, and also get the reaction of our two psychiatrists here about how usual or unusual that story is. Is it a common story that they hear from some combat vets? We'll do that when we come back. The Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about veterans' needs once they come home, particularly when it comes to psychiatric services, psychological services. Cameron is a U.S. Army Afghanistan combat vet. He's with us. Dr. Justin Johnston is a psychiatrist and a director of veteran services at Hopeway, also a command psychiatrist with the U.S. Army Reserves. Dr. Rajiv Ramshan is a senior behavioral scientist and co-director of the Rand Epstein Family Vets Policy Research Institute, and Matthew Smead is with us. He's a veteran and a program manager for Veterans A Bridge Home. How common, Dr. Johnston, is Cameron's story? How many other vets had similar experiences both in and out of the military?
Yeah, I mean, sadly, it is a common story, at least from, you know, patients that I've seen, both at the VA and at Hopeway and in the Army. So a few of the things that he pointed out that are common are, first, you know, this idea of pushing things away or not talking about things, particularly for things from combat, particularly for males. You know, that I think this a theme that's come up today is that many of the struggles of veterans are struggles that are just a broad struggle in American culture. So some of that reflects, you know, masculinity, and you don't talk about things. Also, the piece Cameron mentioned about his wife being the primary driver who pushed him in to seek help, that is a common thing I see with veterans, is that their wife or some family member has sort of forced them into, you know, the last straw kind of thing to get them in to do treatment. And then another interesting piece Cameron talked about was this idea that he actually did better when he was in the military. I see that. Again, I'm still in the Army, and so I still see how many of these folks function better when they're in the Army. They have this sense of purpose, and you know, this direction, and this, like, almost like they're not able to sit with their thoughts, like Cameron had referenced, and then they do worse when they get out. Similar for some of the reasons we talked about, where they lose this camaraderie and now they're able to, like, think about things. I mean, you see it in extreme version when some veterans, when they get out, they are so distressed, they go become contractors, where they go back to combat zones, you know, to seek that sense of thrill. That some of them have gone to Ukraine, for example. There have been stories written about that. So I do think he brings up a lot of things that we see with veterans.
Matt, even if you don't suffer a combat industry injury, or you don't have friends that you went to basic training with who end up losing their lives in the course of combat, even if you don't experience any of that, we put 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds in incredibly dangerous situations. We give them control over multi-million dollars worth of equipment and say, we train them and we say, go do this, and they do. And then they come home, and all that structure and all that responsibility is stripped away, and they're just an average person. What is the impact of that?
You know, it's difficult. You know, I mentioned it before, transition stress. This is, you know, a very difficult time for veterans. And, you know, especially in those first few years coming out of the military, when they're first integrating back into civilian society, that is kind of a red flag time for when they may be most at risk, you know, for issues like suicide. So it's incredibly important to help make sure our service members get the resources and the connections they need right as they're coming out of the military. That's really where Veterans Bridge Home started, was focusing on those service members as they were coming out, making sure they get, you know, the resources and the connections that they need so that they can be successful.
Dr. Ramshad, some of these folks suffer in silence. Some of them exhibit behavioral problems because of what they're trying to deal with psychologically, because of what they went through. If you had to put it on a sliding scale, how, if they seek help, if they get the help they need to the sufficient degree that they need it, which is sometimes a problem, I understand, which we can talk about, but if they get that help, what's the success rate in being able to help these people recover from that and lead normal lives going forward?
It's pretty good. We have really good evidence-based treatments for veterans. So for some of the most common conditions, like post-traumatic stress disorder or depression, we have cognitive behavioral therapy or prolonged exposure therapy, cognitive processing therapy. We have pharmacotherapies. And with the drugs and the pharmacotherapies, that's, you know, sometimes it's kind of finding the right mix or finding the right one for you. It might not be the first one. And some of these treatments, it might not be the first therapist. So you kind of got to find the person that works well with you or the drugs that work well with you. But we should think of it as like a pretty optimistic. Like, we should definitely, that doesn't say that they're effective for everyone. And there are people who have what we call treatment-resistant depression, for example. And there's a need to explore new therapies. We're doing a lot of research, for example, on psychedelics and the potential of drugs like psilocybin or MDMA for treating PTSD. And we need to think about issues like moral injury. So moral injury is something that has been talked a lot about in the veteran community. And that's not necessarily a psychological condition, but it's kind of this notion that you're struggling with doing something that kind of opposes your moral compass. So some of the things that you may have witnessed when you were deployed that kind of alter your moral compass. And is that something that a mental health practitioner can treat, or something that you need something that's a little bit more spiritual? I think people are still working on that. But there is a lot of effective treatment out there, but there's still a lot of way to go. And I just want the one other thing. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
It's okay. Sorry. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say, to Cameron's story, you know, the one thing that I just want to highlight is, you know, as Dr. Johnson said, his wife played this integral role in motivating him to access treatment. And one of the things that we do a lot of research on is caregivers. And we work with the Elizabeth Dole Foundation to focus on supporting people like Cameron's wife and others who are in the role of helping the veteran be successful. And sometimes that's equipping them with the skills to motivate them to go seek treatment. Sometimes it's helping them with their moods when they wake up and they might be upset in the morning or when they're having nightmares at night. So we really want to not just focus on the veteran, but realize that they have family members and caregivers who need support as well.
Dr. Johnson.
Yeah, I think to back up Dr. Ramchaud's point about the treatments we have for things like PTSD, depression, working, you know, Hopeway, we track our outcomes through UNC Chapel Hill School of Public Health. And just to give you an example, 90% of the veterans who came here with PTSD no longer met criteria for PTSD when they left. 85% of the veterans who came with suicidal thoughts were no longer having those when they left. So that's just a small sample size, but it reflects that these evidence-based treatments that Dr. Ramchaud referenced can work, although it does oftentimes take time finding the right ones that do work. So don't want that to, you know, that's frustrating for many veterans. It's not always as easy as like you break your leg and we know exactly how to fix it and we're going to fix it immediately.
And
it
Cameron,
takes
a
while to find that.
I saw you nodding as Dr. Ramchaud was talking about exactly that, that the first treatment may not be the right treatment or the first therapist may not be the right therapist. And I saw you nodding. So clearly you've had experience with this.
I've been through my fair share of therapists over the years. And, you know, I was prescribed countless medications, you know, trying to find the right ones. And speaking to Dr. Johnson's success rate there, you know, when I was at Hopeway, I lived on site, like lived in the facility in the residential department. And I got to see Dr. Johnson on a weekly basis and to figure out and make sure, hey, what's working, what's not working, let's figure this out with the medications. And you are going to DBT, CBT, I mean, all these different abbreviations of treatments, and you're pulling little bits, what you can out of them. And then you see your actual counselor 3 days a week working on specific stuff for your specific traumas. And it's because Hopeway did all of the different features and had you pull from everything and then work on individually is what really was this kind of this salad, if you will. You know, it was not just here's your treatment protocol and we're going to go with it. It's, you know, finding the right treatment, the right time, and with the right person.
Did you start with a VA or the VA hospital and find your way to Hopeway, or did you start with Hopeway? How did that work for you?
So we reached out to, because I needed the residential program. I needed to get away from stressors and really focus on treatment. So we reached out to the VA, and the VA did not have any space available in any of the residential programs. They were full, and they had a wait list. And now I will say that they have a care team that they put me in contact with, and I had recommendations from different psychiatrists and psychologists for Hopeway. So I knew, like, I wanted to go to Hopeway.
Yeah.
And when I reached out to Hopeway, they were like, we have a bed. You just need to get it approved. And so thank goodness to my wife, who really stepped up and was just like, called the VA and was like, get it done.
So Dr. Johnson, you are the Director of Veteran Services at Hopeway. And your services have been described by some as revolutionary. Talk about that. What do you do that's different?
So I try as best I can as a psychiatrist, as a physician, to follow what does the medical literature, scientific research shows that will improve veterans struggling with mental health. So when we set up our program, we really tried as best we could to make as robust a program to offer all of the, you know, Dr. Ramchaud has referenced, we've referenced evidence-based treatments for things like PTSD. So what that means in medical parlance is what treatments have been proven in scientific research to work. And so we set it up offering the big three therapies for PTSD that the VA, the DOD, the APA, every major medical organization would recommend as treatments for PTSD, plus evidence-based group therapies. Plus, I'm obviously a physician, I can prescribe medicine. So I always really track as best I can, what are the latest medicines that can help patients? And so we just try to, and I think being a small program as opposed to the VA, which is an enormous institution, we're sort of a small program, so we can change. Like, we take feedback and we track our outcomes, and if things aren't working, we change them to try to stay as up to date as possible. So I'd say, I guess that would be it. And the other big piece is this, like, multiple times a week individual therapy. That's called masked psychotherapy, which is exactly what Cameron described, where multiple times a week you have a one-on-one session. That's more unusual, although there are a lot of places doing research on it. So that, I think that's pretty unique as well. And it's, you know, obviously Cameron got benefit from it, which is great.
Dr. Ramshaw, I want to come back to something you were talking about a minute ago, and these are the psychedelic pharmaceuticals that are being tested and used. And I know that you are, one of your specialties is research into the changing legal and policy environment using psychedelic substances. Who is testing? Who is conducting the tests on these drugs? Do they help? Do you see or you envision a widening use of them? Because I understand that in some cases, one dose and you're done.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. So the one that is kind of closest, and it was up for FDA approval, and the FDA did not approve it, was MDMA-assisted psychotherapy. So that was an 18-session treatment, three of which involved the administration of MDMA or ecstasy. So, but it didn't approve it yet, and so there's still trials. And then, as I said before, psilocybin has also, which is like magic mushrooms, that's also gaining some interest. So I think that this started as kind of advocacy and nonprofit organizations kind of coalescing and manufacturers who are thinking that it has some potential. But now we see research that's happening within the VA with veterans, as well as the VA just announced that their intent to sponsor some of this research. So I think that people are interested in it. We're still waiting to see what happens. The results from the scientific trial of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy are promising. But there's some challenges, some scientific challenges that we don't want to need to get into here. But
so, Matt, we have the problem of the VA being overwhelmed. It sounds like that they can't handle the flow of vets who need the help. Cameron referenced a waiting list to get into inpatient services at a VA hospital. But then there are a bunch of other situations. I think at one point, nearly 40% of veterans who could benefit from VA services don't even seek them out. Do we understand why?
There's a lot of stigma with mental health. There's a lot of stigma with the VA for a lot of people. Remember, you know, their dad and their granddad going to the VA, you know, decades ago, and, you know, maybe not getting the help they need.
And when you need help and you can't get in, or you make an appointment, and I've read anecdotal stories about people making appointments and then the doctor doesn't show up for those appointments, or the appointments get rescheduled and it's kicked down the road 2, 3, 4 months. It takes courage to come forward and ask this help. What does it do to the vets who are postponed because of the overload and need?
It can be, you know, challenging when you know you need something and you're struggling to get it. But the VA is working really hard on, partnering with local entities in order to help provide vets with what they need. One such example of this is the Staff Sergeant Gordon Parker Fox Suicide Prevention Program. Right now it's in a pilot phase. This is through the VA. Veterans Bridge Home and many other agencies across the country are taking part in this program in order to reach out to veterans that we have screened and are deemed, potentially at risk for suicide. And we are able to connect with these veterans because we do have the military cultural competency that veterans seek. And, we are able to connect with them, work with them, help get them access to resources, be more of a support to them. You know, and again, this is a VA-funded project because, you know, the VA does a lot of things, but no one organization can do everything.
Matthew Smead is a veteran and a program manager at Veterans Bridge Home. Dr. Rajiv Ramchand is senior behavioral scientist and co-director of the Rand Epstein Family Veterans Policy Research Institute. Dr. Justin Johnson, also with us, a psychiatrist and director of veteran services at Hopeway. And Cameron joined us, an actual veteran. Well, we have several veterans on the panel, but he's a veteran from the conflict in Afghanistan. If you know somebody or you yourself are considering suicide, know about the free and confidential 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, available to call, text, or chat.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.